Welcome to the Godspeed Institute, an enlightening and positive forum exploring all the world's religions and spiritual belief systems as an on-air classroom in an effort to help people better understand each other, promote tolerance, and foster peace. I'm your host, Kerr Hallenbeck. Tom Hart is the country director of British charity Health Poverty Action. Based in the Guatemalan highlands, he spends his days trying to ensure that the communities have adequate sanitation, water, and medical care. But when he's not doing that, he is offering blessings to improve their harvests, conducts divinations to find out about their family's prospects, and offers prayers to the ancestors. For Tom is not just an aid worker, he is a priest in the ancient Mayan faith that worships nature there. He is also the author of the book, The Ancient Spirituality of the Modern Maya. Tom, welcome to the program, and thank you so much for being with us today.
Thanks very much, Tara, and happy to be here.
Now, we're Skyping right now to the Guatemalan highlands, yes?
That's right. Let's hope the line stays up.
Right, and that's quite an achievement and a big change from, say, 10, 15 years ago in terms of communication. I'm very grateful for it.
We are indeed. It makes our life a lot more productive, let me tell you.
Well, now, first, yours is such a rich and diverse journey. Can you share with us, from the beginning, sort of where you were born and raised, and were you raised with any religious or spiritual tradition?
Yeah, I grew up in Northern Ireland, and I grew up there with a Church of Ireland background, which is Episcopalian in other parts of the world. That was a full experience in itself, I have to say. Northern Ireland, obviously, growing up in the 70s and 80s, was a place which had religious division. Religion tended to be something that marked out one's life prospects, it marked out one's political views, it marked out where you went to school, it marked out with whom you went to school. Religion, at that time, at least in Northern Ireland, was certainly much more of a dividing than a unifying form, which led me, in turn, to reject religion. And I considered myself for quite some time a non-believer in any religious form at all. And that was the case until I became an adult, until I came to Guatemala.
Well, that's very interesting because it's, you know, the fighting over religion or religion being a factor in people's fighting over land, as it's been used as well. You know, so many throw out the baby with the bathwater, as it were.
Absolutely. And there, as I say, religion was one of the things. It was a badge of identity more than anything else. And a lot of people tended to use it just as a question of their identity. People didn't argue, they didn't debate, they didn't have dialogue about theological issues. It was a question of identifying oneself rather as if it were an ethnicity and a simple division between us and them as much as anything else. For instance, people didn't tend to change their religious persuasion. Mixed marriages between a Catholic and a Protestant were very much frowned upon and were very much the motive for people being shunned by family and friends and so on. And so it was all the negative external forms of religious expression that were used to help conflict, but it was never a question of theological differences or discussing different aspects of spirituality and the difference between the two.
That's fascinating. And I wanted to ask you, did you grow up witnessing a lot of violence at the time?
Not a tremendous amount. I lived in a rural community where we had our share of bombings and shootings, but I went to secondary school in Belfast. And again, just about everybody living in Northern Ireland during the 70s at least can say that they've known people directly affected, direct victims of the violence. But thankfully, I wasn't as directly affected as an awful lot of other people. It was always something that was in the air. It was always something that made a difference to the route you take to school in the morning and the kinds of security checkpoints that one goes through, and friends and relatives who were directly affected and victims of violence.
That's very candid what you just shared about the subtle, you know, like the road you would take, one road as opposed to another, that sort of subtle, constant, you know, but sort of on the back burner culture.
The city itself of Belfast became so segregated that there were Protestant and Catholic streets, and Protestants were advised on how to go through Catholic forms of crossing themselves. Catholics were advised on how to repeat a few words of loyalist songs, because people were, I myself was stopped on several occasions by people in the neighborhood to try and ascertain what religion I was and whether therefore I had any right to be walking down that street or not. So those are the things that everybody learned, and people did learn these kinds of survival strategies in order to be able to deal with day-to-day life and to get on with the business of growing up and going to school and the rest of it.
Gosh, thank you for that. I can relate to some of it, not to the extent that you share, because the neighborhood lines are very often very clear in New York City as well.
I went to
Fordham University in the Bronx, and there were very clear lines there about who can walk in what neighborhoods. And even though we were diverse in studying theology there, as I did, where we went to lunch,
based on
these things.
Exactly. That's very familiar.
So now you, but you still grew up and became interested in working as you do with Health Poverty Action. So did all of this help to form this person that you would become in terms of being interested and compassionate, you know, in order to help people?
I think so, but it also very much left me with a very clear idea of what religion and spirituality ought not to be. All of the years that I considered myself to be an atheist, an unbeliever in anything, was just as important. I mean, I've ended up at the point where I feel that people don't necessarily need a religious identification or membership in order to be compassionate, in order to be loving, in order to be caring. And I've always felt that some of the most saintly people that I know are themselves atheists, and that's fine too. And so I think I had a very clear idea from all of that of what religion ought not to be, and the difference between expressed beliefs and the difference between that and living some kind of moral framework in which compassion and love and helping each other are actually what we're all about.
Yes, agreed. Now, you have been in Guatemala since 1993, so it's
That's
been
right.
20 years this year. And
that's right.
Could you please share about the events that led you there?
Yes, after I grew up in Northern Ireland, I was quite keen to leave. I left Northern Ireland to go and study in England, and I worked in England at the BBC for quite some number of years doing political research there. And really, I got to the stage around 91, 92, where I felt more and more disillusioned with the kind of priorities that I found, partly due to the business of materialism, consumerism, partly also due to what seemed to me a very limited vision of life and its possibilities, and a wider understanding of the world and the community of the world, as it were. People seem to be very caught up in their own day-to-day environment and priorities, which weren't necessarily my priorities. Basically, it was a question of disillusionment as much as anything else. And when I started traveling, I came to Latin America more or less at random, as somewhere to go. It was, if you like, maybe seeking something.
Tom, would you say that the same feeling you had about religion might have also applied to your feeling about politics by the time you got to Guatemala?
I think I had been very involved in the nature of my work. I had been very involved in the day-to-day parliamentary politics and the idea of politics, as it were, as a game. It was a great game, and it was there was a great sense of trying to score points off the other side and so on within the parliamentary framework at that time. And there was never any stepping out of the box. There was never any wider perspective of what a state ought to do, what its responsibilities to its citizens may or may not be. And there was an awful lot of self-interest that seemed to me to be expressed within British politics, at least at that time, in terms of worrying about one's own taxes and economic development and so on. And there was no wider perspective. There were no questions of the wider issues of politics in terms of responsibility towards the community, or in terms of living in within the rule of law, or with communities which have a lack of the very basics of life. And so politics somewhere else, like in Guatemala, for instance, is very much a whole different ballgame. There are some very basic questions that are being addressed in politics all the time.
Thank you very much for that. It's interesting, with a, you know, sort of a disappointment in religion, disappointment in politics, but you still have this great hope. And because that is hope.
Yeah.
You're not a cynic.
Yeah,
right. To go forward.
Absolutely.
Now, tell us about Health Poverty Action briefly. What is it that the organization does?
It takes a rights-based approach to people's right to enjoy the best possible health in communities in Africa, Asia, and Latin America. And basically, rather than trying to give clinical health services in parallel to, let's say, a Ministry of Health, it tries to empower communities. It also engages greatly in the social determinants of health. We know that health isn't a question necessarily of diseases. It's also a question of poverty, access to water, access to support from the state, access to education, and so on. And so it takes a very wide and a very integral approach to what hinders or develops people's health. And it's been working since 1984 in communities, often indigenous communities, across three continents.
And we're going to include the contact information also for the organization at the end of the show, so people can follow you and support your work.
Please.
Now, so speaking about the indigenous peoples, as you just mentioned, what was your experience of encountering the people you met there in Guatemala? Please share with us who they are, what communities you found at some length, and take your time. You have the floor.
Thank you. Well, I think the first thing that struck me, and would strike anyone visiting Guatemala, is that it's very much two countries. It's a country which is technically a middle-income country. It's developed enormously on the surface in the last 20 years. You mentioned that we, like the rest of the world, are now on Skype and Twitter and Facebook and the rest of it. But very much at the back of all that is a huge degree of division between the indigenous and the non-indigenous community. It's a country which has suffered since the arrival of the Europeans 500 years ago, this enormous division. People of European descent are still to this day those with better quality and greater amounts of land, for instance. They're very much the entrepreneur community, the internationally connected business community here in Guatemala. People with wealth and with money in Guatemala live tremendously well. Here we find the very rich with their private helicopters, their holidays in Europe, their university courses in the United States, and so on. But in rural areas where the majority of the indigenous population lives, it's a very different situation. We still have tremendous numbers of people living without toilets, without adequate sewage treatment, without drainage. We have an awful lot of people living in extreme poverty. At the moment, we have an estimated 21% of the indigenous community living in extreme poverty, and an additional 51% living in poverty, which isn't quite so extreme. Life expectations for indigenous people remain considerably worse than those of the non-indigenous population. We're talking about a country in which the average number of years of education is around 4.5 years of primary school education. And basically, the discrimination which had become institutionalized for the 500 years of the clash between the indigenous and European descent people is something that's still very much reflected in Guatemalan society today. Between the late 60s and the mid-1990s, we also had a civil war. And this civil war had many different origins. It was partly a reflection of the Cold War conflicts that were being fought out across Latin America at the time. And it also had elements which were related to the extreme poverty of indigenous people. It was a civil war that lasted for 36 years. In a population of what's nowadays 14 million, we had over 200,000 killed. We had around 1 million people displaced internally or externally as refugees in refugee camps in Mexico. And that's something which has also left tremendous scars right across the community. Some 400 villages were completely destroyed by military anti-insurgency campaigns during that time. That has left a great legacy in terms of people's lack of willingness to engage in formal politics, with people's fear of becoming publicly demanding rights, in terms of people's willingness to get involved in organizations or organize civil society, let's say. And so I think the war has had a tremendous impact, which is going to take another generation to really get over. So we have all of that. At the same time, we have an awful lot of people who suffered physically from the war. Tremendously high rates of anxiety, depression, alcoholism, other forms of substance abuse are very much with us today. Formally, Guatemala is now a democracy, and certainly we have a constitution which gives equal rights to all citizens, indigenous and non-indigenous. But there are all sorts of subtle forms of discrimination and denial of access to rights that are still very much in place. And that can be something as basic and as obvious as the use of language. And by that I mean that for most indigenous people, it's clearly their own indigenous language, which is their mother tongue. Yet when they go along to a health center or when they go to school, they're only dealt with in Spanish. And that's a tremendous barrier, especially for monolingual women who tend to have less education. It's a tremendous barrier to people in the indigenous communities.
This is a devastation on many levels you're sharing, as well as spiritually.
This kind of exclusion in practical terms from ownership of their own country, their own state of Guatemala, means that there has been a process for some generations now in which people are trying to assimilate non-indigenous culture. We've talked to a lot of parents, a lot of members in communities who say, I don't want my children to face the same racism, discrimination, and poverty that I have faced all my life. So it's best that we stop teaching them our own language. It's best that we stop using our own traditional clothing and so on. For that reason, the official census in Guatemala, for instance, says that some 41% of the entire population is indigenous. Whereas most Indigenous activists will tell us that Indigenous people still form a majority ethnically of the population of the country, but people are no longer quite as willing to self-identify as Indigenous people.
Well, you know, here where we are, and of course across the United States, you know, the Native Americans have experienced this as well. And here in Maine, we have several nations here, the Penobscot probably the largest, and each year in August we attend their powwow, which is open, and everyone comes together and they do the ceremonial dances, and there are things we can participate in and may not also participate in, and no photography, and you know, it's lovely, it's a beautiful day, but there are very few representatives at this point coming to the powwows. And of course the use of the language is very important. It seems to be a key way of killing a culture, basically, is through the language and the ending of that language.
Absolutely so. I mean, language is clearly something that contributes greatly to shared values. It's not just the sense of identity. It's not just the sense of sisterhood and brotherhood with other speakers of the language, although that's a part of it. But it obviously also consists of all sorts of ideas, all sorts of values are being transmitted through the use of language and through each individual language structure. Something we might talk about in a moment is the fact that in, for instance, most Maya languages here in Guatemala, such as Quiche or Mam, very often concepts are expressed in terms of dualities, in terms of two simultaneous phrases with the same meaning. And that's a way of subconsciously transmitting the fact that within Maya spirituality, everything has its complement, everything has its partner, everything has a spiritual and a physical dimension. And just the repetition of two words or two phrases, which are synonyms in everyday language, is a way of transmitting that value, that individualism isn't the way the universe is structured.
Tom, could you just give a brief example of that, of the two synonyms together?
Well, for instance, we'd never use an overall word for the ancestors. We'd have to say our grandmothers, our grandfathers.
Oh,
we always use two words, two expressions. And as I say, it's a way of reminding us that everything has its complement. That formal expression or formal discourse, for instance, in most Maya languages, is to an outsider tremendously adorned, tremendously florid, and things aren't stated just simply and basically and so on, but always with these complements, these two ways of expressing things thrown in together. Mm-hmm. We would say in a prayer, for instance, we would never use a word which can translate simply as please. We would say, do us a blessing, do us a favor. It's always two phrases, two words. It has two parts, two elements to represent this harmony, male and female, between the spiritual and the physical. And the whole concept, as I say, is that nothing in and of itself is worth anything unless it has complements, unless it's part of a greater integral whole.
Thank you, Tom. Now, how did you discover the traditional Mayan faith?
When I first came to visit Guatemala, I met a couple of people who were practitioners themselves of Maya spirituality, and they shared with me some of their feeling of being discriminated against and marginalized, because at that time the lack of understanding of Maya spirituality was very much related to a characterization of it as being something dark, something demonic, something to do with sorcery, something to do with Satanism, as it was expressed to me by several people. But at that stage, people were starting to come out into the open a little more in order to be able to share, in order to be able to dispel some of the prejudices that surrounded Maya spirituality. And I very much listened to their stories, and as a non-believer still at that time, I felt it was very much a rights issue. I felt it was very much the case that any people or any individual had the right to express their own form of spirituality, their own form of belief, without being attacked and without being discredited for it. And so at that time I decided to spend some time gathering a series of testimonies from people who practiced Maya spirituality about what they believed and about how they expressed that belief. And so that was very much the way that I started to engage with my spiritual guide, priests, priestesses, and people in communities who have this particular form of religious expression. During the course of working with them, of being invited to accompany them in ceremonies, in offerings, in blessings, and so on, then I really, over the course of just a few months, find myself starting to engage with what they were doing on a much more emotional level. And I began to have a series of particular manifestations, in my own case were repetitive nightmares, which became tremendously intense and started to affect my daily life very directly. And by that stage, I had enough confidence and trust in my priests and priestesses that I consulted them about the reason for some of these manifestations. And I began to hear from a series of people their view that it was one's calling, it was one's destiny, it was one's mission in order to become fully involved in spirituality. And so I never really had a Damascus moment, as it were, of saying, well, suddenly I believe. But by the stage that I was starting to talk to people about my own experiences of these nightmares and some other life problems, I realized that I believed, I trusted in what they were telling me and their orientations and their advice. And at that stage, I decided to accept one's own calling, one's own mission of working within Maya spirituality. Within the belief system, it's not so much a personal choice. It's certainly not a career choice. It's not something that one decides one's going to do. It's more a question of one accepts that this is what one was supposed to do. One accepts that this is one's vocation, one's calling, one's destiny. One of the things that I find myself within Maya spirituality is the idea of the mystical, and the mystical has a tremendous emotional impact when one is engaging, when one is relating to the divine in whatever way we consider the divine to express itself. But it's something that we do directly. It's something that speaks to the heart before the head. And I think that's a very important issue.
Yes, and so from your heart, you decided then to become a Mayan priest. Can you share about that?
The term that we use is always going to be inadequate, because there are terms in Maya languages which aren't quite so easily translatable. But basically, this means that one assumes the role of a guide for other people. And in the case of a formal initiation, I went through several months of preparation in which one has a guide oneself, a teacher as it were, and with that teacher or with that guide, one makes ceremonial offerings. One visits different shrines, one visits different altar places, a series of different sacred spaces. And one is effectively presented to the earth, presented to the ancestors, presented to the spiritual aspect of God in heaven, and one's teacher speaks on one's behalf, presents one, introduces one to the spirits, and so on. These ceremonies, these offerings are carried out according to different days within the Maya religious calendar. A calendar of 260 days or 9 lunar months, which forms the basis of most ceremonial work today. By the end of that stage of preparation, one is formally initiated as a spiritual guide, but it's really only then that that I myself began to walk on my own, as it were, which is to say that the initiation process takes you to the point where I was authorized, as it were, to make ceremonies on my own at sacred sites. But really, that's only the beginning of the process of living spirituality.
Let me ask you, because, you know, there you are, you're, you know, from Northern Ireland, you know, formerly BBC, man of power. Okay. Outside.
That is the key boy, right. Let's be honest.
Now, what was the reaction to you on the part of the people? Were you received with any skepticism or...
Surprisingly little. There were certainly reserves on the part of some people, partly because the Maya have seen people coming from outside the community and appropriating their land, their natural resources, and so on. And there's certainly a fear now people from outside may come and appropriate what's most fundamental to us of all, our very spirituality. So people have tended not to automatically either accept or reject what I do, but to get to know me and to see what I do over the course of time, how one lives one's life, how one relates to the community, how one honors the ancestors, how one engages with the with society, how one engages with the earth, and so on. And so I think those who were doubtful at first are now among my closest friends, which I'm extraordinarily humbled about.
This is Care Hallenbeck, and you're listening to the Godspeed Institute, a program dedicated to spiritually based living and religious tolerance. When we return from the break, we'll continue our conversation on Mayan spirituality with Tom Hart. Stay with us. Welcome back to the Godspeed Institute. You are live with Care, and we're speaking about Mayan spirituality with Mayan priest, or spiritual guide, Tom Hart, who lives and works in the Guatemalan highlands. Now, Tom, you know, I recall some years ago that Sting, the pop star, went down to part of South America and drove into the forest and just left the BMW somewhere and and walked in there for like 2 years on his own with a deep desire, apparently, to reconnect with something that, you know, perhaps you can relate to when we're just have had it with one culture. to reconnect. Now, you stayed. You went to the Guatemalan Highlands and stayed. Do you consider it your home now?
Yes, I do. I have to say that that I can't see myself. I can't see myself leaving Guatemala at the moment. I have assumed certain commitments, and so that means that part of my work within my spirituality means that I have some things which I have committed to do. And people whom I have committed to support. And so, yes, I can't see myself going anywhere at all.
Now, for those who are just joining us, who might have missed the first half of the program, could you just touch base a little bit on what it is that you found in the Mayan experience of spirituality that really touched and helped you in your own life?
I think it was partly the idea that we have to have a new relationship. I say new for those of us who grew up in Europe, at least, a new relationship with the world. And when I say the world, I mean obviously those aspects of our environment which are starting to concern us all. For Maya spirituality, everything has a soul. Everything is alive. And that means not just people and animals and trees and plants. We also mean the storms are alive. We also mean that a house has its own soul, has its own spirit. And so the idea that everything is alive and everything therefore deserves respect is something that people have talked to me about at great length. And I think that's a different way of living. It's a different way of not feeling ourselves to be the owners of nature and not feeling that natural resources are to be exploited just for their own sake or for our temporary ease of living. It's a way of trying to respect our position as members, as elements, as parts of nature, as parts of the world, and that's been tremendously important. It's also the case that my spirituality has given me, at least, a greater perspective, a much broader perspective of where we are and what life's all about. And by that I mean that people within a traditional religion, a religion which is very much passed on from generation to generation, we have a greater sense, I think, of the fact that life is fleeting, life is short. Everything that we do affects everyone and everything else. It affects the generations to come. Obviously, that's in terms of what we do to our planet at the moment, but as well in terms of the values that we teach, in the terms of the values that we live. And so I think the idea that we're just here for a brief moment, that we've come from a whole line of generations who have gone before, and hopefully as great a number of generations who will come after us. So I think it gives a greater sense of perspective. The whole concept as well, I think, of community, of the whole being greater than the sum of its parts, is something that's spoken of quite a lot within my spirituality as well. I mentioned at the start that everything has its complement. We can't speak of the generations without speaking of both grandmothers and grandfathers. We can't speak of God without speaking of our Father in Heaven and our Mother Earth. And the idea that each of us is part of a community, whether that's one's own family, whether it's a community of belief, whether it's a community of ethnicity, or whatever our particular series of communities happen to be. But the idea that the community's needs are very often greater urgency than the individual's needs. I find that European life, at least, is very individually based. And the idea of community and being part of a whole, I think, is something that has at least taught me quite a lot.
As you were speaking about our mortality, or the short time that we have here, In the West, we kind of went the other way with that, and it's the fear of death and our mortality that makes us greedy.
That's
and
right.
want to hoard, you know. There's that old movie Moonstruck. He thinks if he hangs on to his money, he will never die.
That's right.
We've been going in that direction, and we see where the pendulum has swung.
Yeah, I think that's right. I, like everyone else, would look to live as long as possible. But if we're serious as well about our spiritual beliefs, then I think that we really ought to do something about this fear of death. Within my spirituality, we certainly have the concept that the soul is eternal, that our soul is dissolved, as it were, after death, into the soul of the universe, and therefore becomes part of the whole living, breathing universe. For reincarnation, for rebirth, perhaps in a different form, or at least existence within the universe. I mean, it's very much like particle physics when they talk about the idea that every time you take a breath, you're inhaling part of Julius Caesar's last dying breath. There's a recycling of elements. There's a recycling of the most basic elements of the universe all the time. And so I think that trying to get to grips with that is a way of getting to grips with the idea that death may mean the end of a certain part, the end of a certain cycle, the end of a certain journey, the end of a chapter, but it's certainly not the end. And I think that our way of living and working with death is something that that we all need to do. We all need to be much more aware and conscious and accepting of death as part of the natural process. My spirituality also represents death as rest. It's very much the darkness at the end of the day. It's a time of silence. Mm. It's the time of peacefulness, of serenity. And I think that's something that has helped me personally, at least. Here, just to give you a very brief example, both Catholics and people who practice Maya spirituality will often visit the graveyard every Monday. Not just every few years to try and find out where your great-grandfather was buried, as we often do in Europe, but it's a permanent engagement with the dead. It's nothing to be embarrassed about. It's nothing to be ashamed about. It's nothing to be afraid of. This is obviously an ideal, but it's certainly something that I think has a lot to teach those of us who grew up in European societies.
That was palpable, what you just shared there. What you mentioned as well regarding the breath, as you mentioned about Julius Caesar, we're so connected when you share something like that. You could just feel that, the connection that we all have through time.
We do.
In this present world that we live in this moment, fast, present, future.
That's very much the case. I mean, on the most physical of levels, within some Maya prayers, for instance, we might use the phrase, we are your blood, we are your bones. It's a way of saying that the DNA of those who came before are physically in our body. And it's something that we very often don't take into account. We somehow assume that we were born out of nothing. But no, we've come before within prayers. We would say things like when we're speaking of our ancestors, we would remember their tears and remember their sweat as a way of saying that we are here as a result of everything that you have gone through, everything that you have passed through, everything that you have handed down to us. And we have to be equally aware of our role and what we're going to leave behind for the generations that are going to follow us.
Thank you for that, Tom. May I ask you if you could share about some of the celebrations or festivals or ceremonies that you participate mm-hmm. in? What do they include?
Well, we could consider them as consisting, first of all, of a lot of different elements. Part of the elements of a ceremonial offering or a sacrifice is time. We have to set aside the time in order usually to go to a sacred place. a ceremony might only last an hour and a half, or it might last even shorter, or some are quite long. But it involves keeping the day. And by keeping the day, that means it's a day in which the participants ought not to fight, ought not to quarrel, ought not to raise our voices, ought not to scold, until some other day. It's a day that has to be sacred. It's a moment that has to be represented in how we relate to the rest of our community and our family on that day. So setting aside some sacred time is part of it. We also usually go to a sacred place. And sacred places may be places that are considered to be archaeological sites, in other words, the homes of the ancestors, or they may be places where people have traditionally felt a particular energy, and they may be springs, they may be caves, they may be mountain tops, they may be crossroads, all sorts of different places where a formal shrine has been established and has been used as a place of worship for generations. When we're actually setting up a ceremony, as it were, there are different physical elements which are also present, and these are usually consist of different forms of palm or copal incense. They may involve the bark of trees, they may involve myrrh and other kinds of incense. They usually involve both paraffin and tallow candles. They can involve tobacco, they can involve alcohol as an offering for the earth. They may even involve elements to sweeten the earth, such as cacao or chocolate. And given that we're here in Guatemala, the home of chocolate historically, there are all kinds of different elements. But usually, these elements are arranged as an offering pile, as it were. We set the offering alight as we go through a series of invocations. During the course of the ceremony, we usually try to, first of all, ask for forgiveness as our first thing to do. When we ask for forgiveness, we're saying not that we have some kind of guilt complex. We're saying that the earth has supported us. It has given us our food. It has listened to all our nonsense, all our fights, all our rows, all our conflict. And we have to apologize to the earth for that kind of misbehavior. We're apologizing to the extent that we've wasted water. We've apologized to the extent that we've walked past a poor person without giving them some coins. But basically, the first thing we try to do is to recognize our imperfections, recognize our faults, and to ask for forgiveness. The second thing we do is to give thanks, to consciously be aware that even though we don't have everything we might want in life, we still have blessings. And those blessings start with being reborn every day. Every day is a new beginning. Every day is being reborn into the world. And we very often take it for granted. We wake up with a very bad expression on our lips and don't want to get out of bed and don't want to get up. But it's a blessing, the fact that we've woken up, the fact that we have another day in which to be alive. After we give thanks and after we have asked for forgiveness, then we may ask for whatever we're asking for as part of the ceremony's motive. And ceremonies are done to ask for a good harvest. Ceremonies are done to ask for curing and health. Ceremonies are done to improve our communications within the family or with our partner. Ceremonies are done to ask for the blessing of a home or a journey or a school child who's about to enter a new school year. Everything that we do in life can be the motive for a ceremony within Maya spirituality. It's not something that's just reserved for certain aspects of life. People include spirituality as part of their consideration, as part of their engagement with the divine for everything that we are and everything that we do. My spirituality recognizes the fact that we are both body and soul, we're spiritual and material, and that means that God and the divine ought not to be absent from any aspect of our lives, whether we're talking about our sex life, her economic life, her study, everything and anything.
Now, working through boundaries that separate people is a large part of our work here at the Institute.
Indeed.
Now, here you are, starting off as a lad in Northern Ireland and becoming a Mayan priest or spiritual guide down in Guatemala. Can you share how your role has affected your life and that of others in view of religious tolerance and spiritual expression?
Well, I think having grown up in a society which was divided partly and at least ostensibly by religious expression, I think that that has left me as someone who is very, very sensitive and very aware of the necessity to try and understand each other, to tolerate each other, to recognize the fact that each of us has a world of knowledge, a world of experience, a world of lifetime within their heads and their hearts, and that we're equally valid. All of our religious, spiritual expressions are valid. Certainly, within my spirituality, it's not a proselytizing faith. We have no intention of trying to shift someone out of their particular religious or faith-based community in which they find themselves. And so I think the recognition that spirituality and faith ought to be about different things than trying to divide us or trying to claim a certain badge of identity is something that has stayed with me. And I think that's something that one tries to share as much as possible with people who come along. Very often here in Guatemala, there are echoes of the religious division that I grew up with, certainly between Catholics and some kinds of fundamentalist evangelical churches which exist. There are sometimes very bad relationships. And so I think the idea of trying to promote tolerance and understanding is tremendously important. It's also the case that within practice of my spirituality, the same kind of tolerance means that we're not about judging people. And that means that sometimes the people who come to me to ask for advice or to ask for support, sometimes they may belong to the evangelical church, or they may be Catholics, or not just people from my spirituality who ask for support. And one's role as listener, one's role as an advisor or a counselor has nothing to do with trying to judge other people or with trying to condemn other forms of practice or worship or with other forms of life even. Compassion and love and a lack of judgment is something that that's very much part of one's daily practice.
Now, we're coming to the end of the program, and I want to thank you so much for being for speaking with me today. I don't want to call it an interview or a program.
Yes.
It's just a really lovely conversation, and I've really enjoyed our sharing, and I feel I've learned a lot from you as well. But on a side note,
yes.
I'm just curious because, you know, up here in America and probably in Western Europe, there was so much brouhaha about 2012.
Yeah.
I'm just wondering, because you happen to be down there,
yes,
what did your, you know, local friends down there think,
yeah,
about 2012, or were they just laughing at, you know, the Western world, basically?
Well, I think bemused is probably the best description. It's clear that the whole business of celebrating the date was something that came from the north, was something that came from outside Maya communities back in the 80s onwards. Certainly it is the case that in December 2012 we came to the end of a long cycle. The date was perfectly accurate, was perfectly correct. What was missing was a prediction on the part of the ancestors, the generations who had gone before, that this, that, or the other would happen. And so for most people here within the communities and within Maya spirituality, we were perfectly happy to celebrate the date, and we were perfectly happy to give a welcome to the new cycle of time in which we are. But most people, believe me, have far more to do with earning their livings, with getting by, with trying to get access to medicine and justice and education and the rest of it, to be too concerned about the brouhaha of will the world come to an end or not. No, we have enough to be getting on with living today.
If I wanted to ask for a blessing for this new era, what might that sound like?
If we were to say something in English, we would be saying, heart of heaven, heart of the earth, heart of fire, heart of the sea. Forgive us, Mother, forgive us, Father. Perhaps we have forgotten, perhaps we haven't remembered. Perhaps we have been living with an eye to our own futures, without thinking of our brothers, our sisters, without looking after the world that we're going to inherit for our children, our grandchildren. Forgive us, Mother, forgive us, Father, for that. We thank you for our blessings. We thank you that we're here. We're here to see a new dawn. We're here to see a new day. We're here to see our Father sun rise. We're here to see our Mother moon in the night. We're here to thank you, fathers and mothers. We're here to ask for a blessing. We're here to ask for a cure for our souls, a cure for our sadness, to ask for a blessing for our world, for our lives, for our home, for our family. Thank you, Mother. Thank you, Father. A moment, just an instant, our words, our phrases, but with all our love, with all our heart.
Thank you, Tom, and also with you.
Thank you very much. Thank you, Claire.
And thank you, listeners, for joining us for the Godspeed Institute today. The Godspeed Institute is an independent educational organization dedicated to promoting religious tolerance and spiritually based living. If you'd like to hear this or any of our previous programs again, or send it to someone, simply go to GodspeedInstitute.com. Please send your comments to info@GodspeedInstitute.com. We always enjoy hearing from you. And join us again as we continue to explore all the world's religions and spiritual belief systems. Until then, we wish you Godspeed on your journey.